Because dinner table, though, that won't work very well.
This meeting come to order? No, that won't work well at dinner. Call the roll.
Mike Lynch?
Here.
Jim DeMartini?
Here.
Donna Riley?
Here.
Sam Sharp?
Here.
Darren Garrett?
Present.
Lauren Klein?
Here.
Mandeep Dillon?
Here.
Jeff Grover?
Here.
Michael O'Neill?
Here.
Rhonda Biesmeyer?
Here.
We have a call.
Rick or members, any announcements?
I have none. Kelly?
I have an announcement. Hi, I wanted to introduce to you Colleen Biesman. She's our new retirement accountant. She comes to us from CSA. She has a bachelor's degree from the Washington Women's College and has been a years on the team. I'm very happy she's here.
Thank you.
The public comment, we have one member of the public here, so I need to read this. Matters under jurisdiction of the board may be addressed by the general public before or during the regular agenda. However, California law prohibits the board from taking action on any matter which is not on the posted agenda unless it is determined an emergency by the Board of Retirement. Any member of the public wishing to address the board during the public comment period shall be permitted to be heard once up to 3 minutes. Please complete a public comment form and give it to the chair of the board. Any person wishing to make a presentation to the board must submit the presentation in written form with copies furnished to all the board members. Presentations are limited to 3 minutes. So I don't have a request. Do you?
No, sorry, I didn't do that.
That's all right. We'll take it out later. Okay, consent calendar.
Move to approve consent calendar.
Is there a second?
Second.
All those, it's been moved and seconded to approve the consent calendar. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries unanimously. The next item is our investment report. Are you up for it, Rick?
Yes. This is item 6A. This is the report out on the due diligence trip from the due diligence committee. This is an information item only, and I will turn this over to Chris Wisdom.
Sure. So this is just a trip report on a trip that occurred the last week of June. The due diligence committee, missing Trustee O'Neill, visited the Dodger Talks, White Oak, and Black Rock in San Francisco. Again, these meetings just focus for the most part on risk, operations, and compliance issues, some of the business issues here, rather than investment topics. Each term also returned a thorough questionnaire as part of that process, and we maintain that in our records. And the idea is really just to confirm that as of today, we would be willing to again invest in this. We have no issues there, and the result of the trip was satisfactory. The company is comfortable with what we sell these firms. So, if any questions, we're happy to answer those.
Okay. Ferris, where's that?
Right here.
At the table.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Yeah.
I've been new to it for 10 years.
We are going to pass out an updated flash report. It came to me after I put out the packet, so.
That's different than
this. Just so you don't confuse, yes. Slightly, I believe it was the market value that changed.
While that's going on, the June flash report that you're seeing shows now the fiscal year to date having been completed, 8% net of returns. So happy to see that and above the actuarial assumed rate. All of the managers performed largely as expected, no changes to personnel or processes or any issues that raise any flags for us. As you can tell, we see U.S. equity markets outperforming international. So lots of discussions there naturally, which you'll be hearing more about. In fact, we have a conference call that our CIO leads each quarter that first introduces our quarterly research. And you hear it from me at our August meeting. But that will be your first glimpse. If you want to dial into it, that's something that we send out. And you can see on our website of how to dial in and get the materials in advance and hear him talk about some of his thoughts on what's going on in the markets. Naturally, international markets are a big topic given the trade issues. Also, relative disparity now we're seeing between what our central bank is doing with the Fed raising rates and other central banks around the world still wrestling with lower growth and trying to stimulate the economies there. Fixed income that you're seeing here, negative return for the month, is partly due to that increase in rates. We should be happy that we're on the shorter end of the curve with shorter duration positioning than most pension plans that have a core plus kind of structure. On page two, you see real estate did rather well, largely driven by the REIT index, so BlackRock U.S. real estate. So we're repositioning, and we've talked about the repositioning of the real estate portfolio as we want to draw out of REITs and get more into long-term holdings because of the volatility that REITs represent. They trade a lot like small-cap stocks, and here you're seeing. So for the month, up 4%, and small-caps are also up. And so they tend to have that kind of volatility, which is a little bit different than what we're trying to get in the pension plan. Then we see direct lending, which we don't have updated information yet, given that those managers report quarterly valuations and lag. And then risk parity, you can see down, both managers down about 1% for the month, and that also has to do with the rise in interest rates as they have significant fixed income exposure there.
So Ed, on the direct lending, we have nothing from these people?
That's right. We get quarterly valuations, and so this is a flash report as of the month of June 30. So over the course of the next couple months, we'll get those reports in from them. But because it's so lagged, we end up reporting to you with that time difference. So you only see updated information on direct lending in your quarterly report. This is consistently blank. And then we give you the updated information there.
Next month.
We have no information from the previous quarters on this?
We do. That was given out last month, I believe, on the previous quarter. They're about 2 months behind.
So, Ed,
you know, those investments, it's hard to tell how well we're doing on them. I'm a little skeptical about them.
Well, there are several pages dedicated to it in the quarterly performance report. So this portion in your quarterly is filled out, so you have that information. And then we have two other sections dedicated to this type of manager, to closed-end funds. One is to show the funding progress based on what was committed, how much has been called, how much has been distributed back to us. So we see that cash flow reconciliation. And then we see the net and gross internal rate of return. So you can see how the county is doing in total for each one of them in terms of the internal rate of return number, which is the best way to measure the performance here.
So it's not possible to get monthly information on these investments anyway because they only value the investments every quarter. So if we were to give numbers or try to put a number on there, it'd be a guess. And that's
Well, would it be possible to put like the last quarter and then the note saying update coming in September or whatever?
I think the last quarter is on there. Is that correct, Ray?
Those are the asset values
just as of the day.
So you might think about something like that. You look at it, it just looks like we don't know anything about this.
So it's likely the overall 8% that the fiscal year ended with will likely be slightly lower than 8,
or higher.
Or higher.
Depends,
yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
It's a pretty typical problem, though, that every fund has. It takes a couple months before they get their final numbers before they can report out.
In June of the fiscal year, the end of the fiscal year. I don't see why you couldn't, on these other direct lending, have something for fiscal year to date or something.
Well, the fiscal year to date does end on June 30th, and that's kind of the problem, is we don't have June 30th information.
For example, in real estate, you need to have an appraisal done to get a value rent, so they don't appraise every day or quarter or month.
Okay, well, I guess we'll get that eventually then.
We actually see most public plans move to quarterly reporting and get away from that. And so part of it is that this issue, in terms of if we don't have it, don't show it. The other side to it is that as a long-term investor, thinking over 30 or 40 years, 1 month does not a decision point make. And so try to capture more in quarterly data. It also helps as larger plans tend to get asked more questions by other entities about their performance reports and what have you. And it just becomes bogged down in terms of describing what those things show and all the caveats and everything. So honestly, what we're seeing in terms of best practice is to get away from the monthly flashes. they can be informative, and so we want to know if anything's happening with any of our managers, so I certainly respect that need of a fiduciary of a board member trying to make sure you're covering your bases on that. But, you know, we come to you every month and have a good sense of has anything changed with the personnel at any of the firms, any SEC or regulatory kinds of issues, any changes in philosophy or process, which tend to be very rare, but those things do occasionally happen.
Members, any comments or questions? Jim, are you?
No, it's okay. I just have to notice that the U.S. equities look pretty good on here, and this is the kind of stuff we're being recommended to get out of. It's the stuff that's doing the best.
That's why our conference call is a good one to listen to. So that gets into more of the valuation discussion. And so historically, things that have done well tend to not do as well going forward because the valuations are high. And so it kind of leads to the discussion about what's driving the performance historically and what's driving it prospectively and thinking about it critically.
I don't think you and I see things the same way.
Probably not.
I mean, you're the one who's pushing us for the risk parity there, and that looks like it's doing about as bad as it can get. And, you know, to move out of U.S. equities, which is our best performer, I have to kind of question your judgment.
Well, the judgment is sound because what we're trying to do is create a total portfolio that delivers the best risk-adjusted returns that we can get. So the individual components have their periods of outperformance and underperformance, and that's what we want. We want the blend of some things doing well, some things not doing well, and then them offsetting later. And that helps us give us the best, lowest volatility expected return for what we can do. So I'm very comfortable with that recommendation and what it's done for us. What we've shown it to do is play defense well. And so when we have up markets, they tend to lag. And when we have down markets, they tend to do well. And right now we're in kind of choppy markets. And we have choppy markets with a rising rate environment. And that's kind of an odd situation. But that's kind of what we're living through. And it's doing what we would expect it to.
So, Ed, have you finished your flash report? Are we going to just morph into the other?
I have finished my flash report.
Okay.
I think we're ready.
The next item, board members, we've had on the calendar twice in our last two meetings, and in both cases we put it over without taking any action so that all of us could participate. And the this is the asset allocation review and approval of how we're going to invest our money. Is that a fair?
Very fair.
So how do you want to handle this?
So I'm gonna take this. I'll let you know how this is going to break down.
Okay.
So Trustee Lynch is correct. This is the asset allocation review, the annual asset allocation review. And I'm going to give you an update on, or kind of try to lay out for you now how this will progress today so you have an idea of where we're taking this. So today there'll be four parts to this discussion. The first discussion we're going to have is a short presentation. We're going to dive just a little bit more into private equity to let you know what it is we're getting ourselves into and to give you some information that would allow you to make a prudent decision later on in the day when we ask you to make that decision. Then I'm going to turn it over to Ed, and he's going to give an update on emerging market debt. I know that there were still some questions on that topic as well. And then finally, we will turn it over to the discussion and action to the board to decide whether this is something that they want to do. You'll be presented with the same five asset allocations that you were presented with last month. And we're anticipating that you'll make a decision today on that. And then pending the outcome of the asset allocation that's chosen in that item, then we may have a closed session to discuss how we implement that asset allocation. So that's pretty much how this is going to break down today. So let's start, and if we can bring up the presentation there on private equity. Thank you. So you've all heard this before, so this is going to be actually pretty brief. Just a reminder of the private equity asset class, why staff believes that private equity is a good idea for the portfolio. It produces higher expected total returns. Perhaps more importantly, it adds an element of diversification to the portfolio. It kind of tags on what Ed was talking about. When some assets are doing well, others don't. And so this provides a dampened portfolio, overall portfolio risk, and a superior Sharpe ratio when you include private equity in the portfolio. It also offers an illiquidity premium. In other words, it allows us to tie up our assets for an extended period of time because we don't need those assets to pay benefits. We have our benefit shortfalls covered. And so theoretically, that allows us to capture an illiquidity premium that's associated with these long-term type investments. And then it also, out of the five portfolios that you'll entertain today, it also offers the best chance to attain our current discount rate target of 7.25%. I want to set the stage for the rest of this presentation, and it basically all centers around this slide here. It's very important to realize that manager selection is one of the critical components to a successful private equity implementation. And as you can see, the chart on the right is data that was given to us by Verus, and they actually added, I believe, 8 more years. When we were on the diligence trip and we met with Verus, I think Trustee Grover asked them if we could get some more data, and they actually provided us with more data. So what this is on the right is a chart of the dispersion of returns between the upper quartile and the lower quartile managers. And so you can see that it's obviously a good idea to try to avoid the lower quartile managers and pick the above quartile managers. And so that's really what we're attempting to do when we are looking to hire a consultant to help us implement this program. That consultant, through their diligence and history and past relationships, they can provide us access to those managers in ways that Stanford can't. But there are things about private equity that we're going to talk about here in the next few slides. And so what the whole goal of my discussion with you today is that if we go into this asset allocation, we are going to need to hire somebody to help us implement this allocation, to help us get access to those top-tier managers. That's going to cost us money. But we want to make sure that you're comfortable with the elements that go along with private equity, because if you're not, now's the time to speak your mind, because if we get to a point where we agree to go into this asset class and we hire somebody to come in and manage this process and then you start picking it apart, it may get to the point where the value that we may derive from getting into this class may dwindle somewhat. So we just want to make sure that we put all our cards out on the table and we all understand what we're getting ourselves into before we commit to this. So the next 5 slides, and that's all I have, are things that I think that may cause heartburn a little bit for us. A lack of control on the individual investments once we hire this manager. This is nothing new. We've always had that. We hire the direct lenders that we hire. Once we hire them, they're the ones that go out and make the investments. There are managers that will consult with LPs that have a seat at the advisory committee, but that still doesn't preclude them from being able to make these investments. So this is nothing new. We will not have the ability to veto any individual investments, but the board obviously will always have full transparency after the fact, after they make these investments. Here's a new one. Possibility of not interviewing potential managers. So there's a lot of capital that's flowing into this space right now. And frankly, because of that fact, some managers may not want to spend the time and come out and sit in front of you like we've been accustomed to in the past and be interviewed. Be comforted, though, perhaps by the fact that if we do hire the specialty consultant to help us engage in this asset allocation, that these managers have generally been thoroughly vetted by the consultant. And in that respect, the consultant has also is putting their name on the line somewhat by bringing these to us and recommending them. We found out that it still may be possible to do on-site visits before committing. We don't know whether that's definitely for sure or not. The Verus group in San Francisco couldn't guarantee us that either, so We don't know if that's true or not.
And it all depends on the timing of their fundraising process. Some of them have more elongated timeframes and have first close to final close and have a window of opportunity to work with them. Some move very quickly because they have a lot of pent-up demand and they want to close the fund and get going. So it just kind of depends.
And would it depend on the manager too?
Very much so.
Some of these investments are not, they're atypical of what Stansera has been used to in the past. There are a couple ones that I think that, I know that you were introduced to these a couple months ago when Chris talked about them, but just to reiterate that venture capital is an investment where there's going to be a lot of losers and there's going to be a lot of winners. Venture capital generally tends to look for innovative new young companies that may have a new product or a new service. And a lot of those don't actually make it, but generally the returns from this type of fund are gleaned from those winners. The winners are pretty big relative to the losers, but nonetheless, you have a portfolio with losers that are a part of that. Buyout funds, they may add value to investors by restructuring the company. In the process, they may have to lay people off and do some stuff that may be considered socially undesirable. Those are definitely two possible investments that we would be making. Just as a aside, I did look at CalSTRS' private equity allocation, and 76% of CalSTRS' private equity allocation is venture capital and buyout funds. So I don't know what your experience is with your other clients, but it generally seems like these two are very prolific in terms of the value and the returns that are gleaned from this asset class. So if this is something that bothers you, we need to talk about that right now. We don't want to get into this and spend the money and then decide we can't stomach this type of investment.
Well, I mean, I've got some, are you saying nobody in this organization will know where they're investing our money? Is that what you're telling me?
No. I don't understand that question.
If we do one of these private equity firms,
yep.
We give them $100 million.
Yes.
After the fact, we get to know where the money went.
Yes.
Does anyone know where the money went before it went? Are there discussions? Are there any exchange?
Oh, the vetting process at the manager level?
No, but you know, that's just like Dodge and Cox. We don't talk to them about what stocks they're going to
buy. But you could.
Fidelity or LSD. So.
You could though, right? You could call them if you had a question.
Before the fact?
Yeah.
We wouldn't know before the fact. We could see it on a report and we could ask after the fact once it's in the portfolio and we see it there. We could inquire as to why they made that investment.
Very close to what we do in the real estate space, I think. So we would work with a manager that has certain expertise. They've done this before a number of times. So, you know, Greenfield that we have a couple of funds with. We know the sort of work they do. And then when we decide to fund or allocate to the next fund, it's kind of a blank check. But then property by property, as they purchase and value, we hear about it and it's reported to us. But it's based on their reputation, their expertise. I can't tell you what Greenfield's going to do 6 months from now.
Yes, sir.
How many of the 37 Act systems have private equity investments?
17 out of the 20.
Okay.
Yeah, so we're in the minority. They implement them in a variety of different ways, anything from fund to funds to direct investments like we're considering. Mendocino is the smallest 37 Act county, and they consider themselves just too small to even consider this. Sonoma doesn't feel that they can consistently get access to the top hotel managers. They just decide to focus elsewhere. The rest of the counties, the other 17, feel that we can add value.
We're talking about 5%?
We are talking 5% private equity and 6% in private credit.
So it's $100 million?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
To private equity. Actually, I think it's 6% to private equity, isn't it?
Well, it depends what we vote on here.
Either way, it's close. 5%.
Actually, yeah.
Thought
it was
private credit.
Yeah.
Okay.
It'll probably be in the low $100 million, and it's something that we build up to over time, little by little.
Okay. So this really, these things really lead us down to a path to where we want to discuss the dilution of the private equity opportunity set. If the board agrees to going into this asset class, we will have a discussion, an action item sometime in the next month or two to set the governance parameters for this program. Ed and Chris could probably talk a little bit more about it if you want, but we'll talk about acceptable type investments. Maybe if there's geographic restrictions and use of leverage, we'll talk about those then and set those in the parameters for this program at that time. The main thing that you need to know is that eliminating certain investment styles and stuff like that will actually produce a less optimal portfolio. And by excluding some of the investment types, you're probably going to exclude some of the good managers that are associated with those investment types. And my biggest concern is not today, it's 5 years from now, and that is if we do something like this and we start to pare down the potential of this asset class, and then we look at it 5 years from now and we make a judgment call based on the portfolio that we implemented at this time, it may lead us to the wrong conclusion about this asset class. It may lead us to believe that our peers are outperforming us, so this is not good, or the returns we're getting aren't what we expected. So my concern is that when we do start to pare down this opportunity set, that it could lead us to a false determination of the value of this program down the road.
Wait a minute. You're saying that in 5 years from now, if it's not doing well, we're going to pare it down, right?
No.
Why is that different than anything else?
What I'm saying is that if we start to pare down this opportunity set right now, let's say we start to eliminate buyout funds and venture capital, but we start to go into the rest of it, 5 years from now, when we look at the returns that we've gotten from this asset class, we may get the wrong impression and place an incorrect value on this program when we look at comparing ourselves to our peers or even comparing ourselves to our benchmark if we start to leave out these investments that generally tend to augment and produce some of the higher returns that are expected from this type of investment.
So, for example, you're saying if we say we don't want anything outside of California.
Yes.
And in 5 years, our other 16 peers have invested inside,
right.
Outside of California. You're not comparing apples to apples.
But then we just assume, well, the program's not working and this asset class is just not a good asset class, so let's get out of it. I just don't want that to happen. I want us to go into this with our eyes wide open.
We talked about this a couple of months ago. We heard from the board that there was a desire to have some ability to customize. There were concerns about certain asset classes or otherwise. And so we do want to have a program that allows for some customization. I think the point that we're making is that the more we limit the opportunity set, the more chance we have getting the potential value out of the program. So we just want to be cognizant of that.
So that being said, let me make one other comment. It's okay if you don't want to go into private equity. It's not going to make or break us here. I truly believe that. I don't think 5 years from now, whoever's sitting at this table is going to say, geez, they made a bad decision 5 years ago. Look at this. I don't think there's going to be any evidence necessarily that would tend to suggest that. I think the returns from this come from the diversification benefits in the portfolio, and I think that they theoretically should give a higher rate of return based on the illiquidity and the premium that these private equities should give over a public market. There's more risk involved. You should get a higher return. But is it going to solve all our problems? Of course it's not going to solve all our problems. Is it? Are we going to look back again, like I said, and say, oh, we made a mistake? Oh, it's probably not going to happen. So I don't want to feel like we're pressuring you here. This is staff's recommendation. We feel it's best for the portfolio, but it's not going to kill us.
Rick, are the fees on these kinds of investments, are fees higher or lower?
Much higher.
So they're charging us more.
That's right.
Not to answer our questions.
However, the returns that we look at and analyze when we come up with these capital markets expectations are net of fees. So all the analysis being done is net of fees, taking that into account.
I think you'll be able to have all your questions answered, though. They're transparent groups. The ones that we're looking at, the ones that we would recommend, are top quality managers, and they tend to be transparent about it. So we don't have the advance notice before they make the investment, but we don't want that either, because then that puts you in a different fiduciary responsibility of approving or disapproving individual investments, which we're not equipped to do. So we delegate that over, and we have the agreement that says, you're responsible for doing it, here's why we pay you, and we're holding them accountable that way. And then once anything's in the portfolio, they'll tell us what we need to know. That reporting has never been an issue with these managers. So pay them more, yes. Expect higher returns? Yes. Historically, past 10 years, across private credit, buyout funds, and venture capital, you're seeing 9 to 9.5% annualized returns. That's pretty good. If you go back over 20 years, you then incorporate a bit of a different regime, so I think it's not quite apples to apples because there was the dot-com bubble and what have you. But there you're looking at 20-year annualized returns for venture capital of 25%, and buyout and private credit 10 to 12%, something in that range. So these are meaningful return enhancers. They are additional sources of return, so they do have that.
So what do we, I won't belabor this issue. Well, we have Rick, we have Chris, we have you. All right. At what point, I mean, somebody gives these guys a check, and then they go and spend it on investments as they see fit. Well, why do we need three people to pass the check? Why do all three of you have to pass the check? Why can't, if we're just assessing the manager's skill level, his history, all those kinds of things, which we do for all the managers all the time, why do we need another consultant for that?
They have
a specialized set of expertise that we can't weigh in on anyway.
I think that's a good reason why is the graph on the right is trying to access those managers that provide the higher returns. We don't have those relationships. We wouldn't know where to go to try to find people like that other than start a Google search and try to figure out who's good and who's not. A lot of funds hire specialty consultants to farm out the entire program. The board doesn't even weigh in because some of these specialty consultants have developed relationships with these managers over many years, and these managers will only let those consultants have access to those funds that they have relationships with. This is an exclusive club, is that maybe a good way of putting it? And there are a lot of managers who wouldn't even entertain us. Chris were to pick up the phone and talk to them and ask them to entertain us making a contribution to their fund, becoming an investor, they wouldn't even entertain us. We need the relationships that the folks out there that work in this industry day in and day out have made with these top-tier managers.
And internally, we have a separate team dedicated to this space. And the reason for that is the due diligence on our end is much higher, knowing that whenever we take a look at a private equity fund, we treat that fund as the next extension of what that manager is doing. So we can rely somewhat on knowing that manager and getting comfort of the people and what they've done before and what have you. But each time we underwrite a fund, we underwrite it as its own individual fund. And so we go back and recreate the performance history of each of the people involved in managing that fund, what past investments they individually have made to prior funds, and taking a look at their track record and building it up that way and getting comfort that they're doing this one the right way and it's worthy of consideration. So we have a dozen people dedicated to it separately just for private markets. It's that.
So, but what this really amounts to is us adding a fourth expert, because we've got you and Chris and Rick. So we're going to add a fourth entity to be another expert to recommend who we invest with.
For better or worse, it'll still come through me. If you hire
I understand, but you say we have to hire some additional expertise that you and you don't meet the cut on that.
Well, and no disrespect to Rick, but I don't think you would consider yourself an expert.
That would be
not. Yeah,
I mean, no disrespect to Rick.
I wasn't mean disrespect.
I know he was. No.
Well, and just like in any industry, you have specializations.
Right.
Doctors specialize in certain areas. You know, even accountants do. And you gain that specific knowledge on that area.
That is a good analogy there, the GP and the specialist doctor, I think.
Yeah, my doctor doesn't tell me anything anymore. He always refers me to someone else.
Somebody else.
Well,
is
it frustrating?
Yeah.
It is
frustrating. So the last slide just talks about fees. Smaller institutional investors like ourselves really don't have a lot of leverage anymore. The structures that we may get in terms of fees may come from the relationships that our specialty consultant has with these managers. A lot of times they set them up and they are flat structures, and if you want to get into this fund, that's what you get into. And then finally, we do have an extra disadvantage because of AB 23, the increased reporting requirements by California funds. It is shutting out some California funds. That's definitely a fact. So just by the mere fact that we live in California and we operate in California is going to pare down that potential pool of managers a little bit. I don't know how much, but. So there you have it. That's the discussion on the private equity. If there are no more questions, of course you'll have an opportunity when we discuss the final asset allocation, but if you have no more right at this moment, I'll turn it over to Ed to talk about emerging market debt.
So again, we'll hear from Ed on emerging market debt, and then we'll look at the asset allocations. I know those include those asset classes, and then some of any of them actually.
So emerging market debt, we have a few slides here just to give you some background in it, but really designed to answer any questions that you have. Emerging market countries, I think we've talked about them before in terms of the equity space. And in the equity space, what we show here, the MSCI list of 24 emerging economies, these are the 24 that have functioning stock markets and why they might be considered emerging markets for equity purposes. For debt purposes, it's very different because what you're typically investing in is the country. So it's kind of like you're buying U.S. treasuries, you're buying Brazilian equivalents of treasuries or Pakistan equivalents of treasuries. They tend to be government-issued bonds. There are some corporate bonds as well in these countries, but largely we're talking about sovereign nations. And so there are really two groups to think about here, and it's because of the currency issues that we have with emerging market countries. And they fall into hard or local, or hard or external and local currencies. And so emerging market countries, when they go to issue debt, they have to go out to the markets and say, okay, here's what we want to issue, and here's what we're willing to pay for a coupon. And then investors say, okay, I'm interested in that, or I'm not. Well, for countries that are really small, there's a big currency risk there. And so the investors say, yeah, we don't want your currency. We want you to issue the bonds in U.S. dollar. And then the country takes on the currency risk because they have to pay back the bond in U.S. dollar terms. So regardless of what their currency is doing, however it's fluctuating, they have to pay back dollars. And that's called hard. And so there's a choice of U.S. dollars or British pounds, or euros, I think Japanese yen, I think there are four in there total, but mainly as U.S. investors, we're focused on U.S. dollars. So a lot of emerging market countries do that, 65. There is a group that are larger and more stable that are able to issue in local terms. Their currencies are less volatile, and so they can tap the markets in that way. And that, there's about 15 countries there. So the big difference there is just the hard and local. When we take a look at managers and say, what's the best way to play this? We find that there are a number of managers that do blended portfolios. And so they're making the decisions about, in this country, I want to own local. In this country, I want to own hard, or I don't want to own anything at all, or what have you. And so they tend to be some sort of blend across the two. So this is a perfect page then. So then we have the evolving opportunity, local rates, currencies, hard currency bonds, and corporate debt. So the purpose of getting emerging market debt into a portfolio is another source of investment return, which more sources of return diversify our risk across a broader set. That's generally good in terms of portfolio creation. And so it gives us exposure to local rates. Local rates in these countries, their interest rate policies are different than those of the U.S. So as we're raising rates here, and as we have our own tensions of growing our economy, they have their own tensions. And so it gives us diversification in rates exposure. Rates in general tend to help us in terms of market corrections, but emerging market debt is probably the most risky fixed income asset class. So if we take all the asset classes and line them up from riskiest to least risky, you'll go through all the equity stuff, emerging market equity, U.S. equity, international equity, all that stuff, then you'll get to emerging market debt and then the rest of the fixed income spectrum. So that's kind of where it falls out, that this has some bond-like protections in it, but these are covenants, these are responsibilities of the countries to repay, but they also fluctuate with market conditions, and so they do have some volatility with them. If we jump ahead to page 6, we can see how much this market has grown. And so in the upper left-hand slide, this graph shows the growth in corporate, hard, and local. So corporate is the bottom section. You can see that back in 2003, it was effectively zero, and it's now grown to probably $750 billion today. The orange section is the hard currency, where these countries have to pay back in dollar terms or something, another stable currency. Then the top chart, or the top portion of that chart, is the local currency, and you can see how much that has grown since 2001. So an interesting asset class, because while it extends back to 93 on this chart, two of those key factors have developed since then. And that's important because the emerging market countries, as they continue to evolve and develop, they're getting more access to foreign capital. They're recognizing that foreign capital is necessary for them to grow their economies, that they have to access it through institutional investors like ourselves, which is what this chart overall shows. And so you can see that it's over $3 trillion in assets today. And that the dynamics are changing quite a bit. And so it's not shown on this chart, but in terms of currency management and how many are had historically pegged their currency to the dollar, when they come under economic stress, they can't maintain that peg. Their currency breaks, they have a collapse, and then they have to start all over kind of thing. Well, few and fewer are pegging to the dollar. They're allowing their currency to float, and they're dealing with it just like we do. Our currency floats against all the other currencies out there in the world. So that has really changed significantly, and that's why a lot of this growth has happened since 2001.
And the market's grown significantly here. Would you say that this also mirrors U.S. institutional investors' interest in the asset class? Has there been in the last five-ish years, if I'm seeing that correctly, that lenders have started allocating
it? Very much so. Okay. And so the right-hand chart right beside that is showing that story. So you can see the flows into hard and local currency, and you see a significant uptick in 2010. You see 51 and 35, and then more investment in 11, and a lot more in 12. 13, 14, 15, changing behavior there, net inflows, net outflows, and then a resurgence in 16 and 17. So
hard currency is the dollar or the euro? Local currency is whatever the local country is.
Right.
Dollar. Is it just the euro and the dollar? Is there anything else in hard currency?
I think there are four. I think there's the euro, the dollar, the yen, and the pound.
Okay.
If you're Googling it and want to correct me, I'm fine. I think I'm missing one, but I think that's right.
Do you know why it dipped in 13, 14, 15?
A lot of this had to do with U.S. interest rates. And so when the U.S. started changing interest rates, and we started to tighten in 15, but there was a taper tantrum in 2013 where we first discussed possibly pulling back. Anytime we pull back, it has international implications, right? So emerging market countries and their markets, stocks and bonds react to things like that. So for example, emerging market equities year to date have had a pretty significant pullback. And that pullback is largely driven by the trade discussions, because if we have issues with China, and China is trading with all of these others, then it weakens their markets. And so it's things like that. The lower left-hand side is an interesting chart, because here it shows external. We're using external in this chart instead of hard. But you can see calendar year returns for each of them, highs and lows. So it gives you a sense that 2015, the local bonds yielded a negative 15%, while corporates were a positive 1.3%. In each year there. And then the risk return on the right-hand side helps us see how these are positioned. So you can see EM local and EM external in there, and how that compares on a risk return versus the others. So again, we look at this as another source of return and a risk diversifier. This isn't a silver bullet, so we're not saying, you know, go with a 20% allocation here. I think we have a recommendation in our model of 2% to hard and local, representing a blended approach that we could probably find as a manager or two that would give us a blended approach. And then on page 7, a couple of the different indexes that we would measure performance against. Take a couple of the key characteristics here. Top line, you're seeing the duration of hard currency at 6.8 and local at 5, so it has some interest rate risk. Yield to maturity, both, close to 5.9 and 6.5%. So that's the return enhancer. Investment grade, you can see that the hard currency has some high yield in it, whereas local does not. And that again makes sense because they're not coming to the market with their local currency unless they have good credit rating in the first place. And then the market caps, number of issuers, and then down at the bottom, the number of countries. So here's the 65 and 15 that I was referring to earlier.
Is that data still accurate?
Yes. We could update it, and the numbers would change a bit, but yes. It's
general.
Generally correct, yeah. And then pages 8 and 9 just show country weights. So in the hard currency, you can see in the upper left, that Mexico is the largest issuer, and then Indonesia, Philippines, Brazil, etc. And in local currency, Indonesia is the largest, Mexico, Poland, Brazil. And so interesting that you see Mexico in both, so they have a choice whether to issue in hard or local currency, and they just start sizing up the markets and finding out what's most attractive at that point in time as to how they want to do it. So there is some overlap. Next couple of pages just discuss implementation, and page 12 is kind of the pluses and minuses for each one.
Just a quick question, but back on the other in the country weight. Am I not seeing India on there?
They are not all listed. Oh. If you notice, it's like one every third, or every third bar is listed, just because it wouldn't all fit.
Okay.
I can probably find that detail, though. I would think India would be there, yeah.
Yeah, they don't line up even close.
Yeah.
Am I trying to draw the little lines?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's every other. So it's like Mexico, then the missing one, then Indonesia is that third one.
Okay. So one of the things people hear about every now and then is something like, you know, Argentina decides not to pay back their
So why did you use Argentina, for example?
Yeah, exactly.
Because they have defaulted.
They defaulted, exactly. So that's reality. Just like U.S. companies default to, default risk is a thing in fixed income. But how do you explain to an institutional or public plan that that this kind of risk can be managed?
You hire active management, so Argentina will be in the index, whether the individual manager looks at that and says that's a good buy or not, and assessing the credit risk is key, having people on the ground in that area, maybe not in that specific country, but in that region at least, is also comforting. And so that gets to a lot of the implementation issues, and yeah, you have to avoid the landmines.
Yeah.
But neither of these lists of countries are exclusive. Our manager could do some other country that's not on either list.
Generally not. And so that can be part of the investment management agreement as to what guidelines we say. And so if we can say to track the JP Morgan EMBI or GBI index, yada, 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 and declare in there how much. So if they are allowed to go out of index, no more than X percent or something like that. And if they go out of the index, there's a good chance they're investing in U.S. bonds for cash management or something like that.
So there's no exclusive list of countries, right?
No.
We could arbitrarily put some into the agreement, but that's up to us based on whatever whim we have at the moment.
Yeah, and the convention is to use one of the two indices. So JP Morgan is providing an index on hard and an index on local.
But I mean, he just mentioned that neither index had Argentina.
Oh, they do.
It's
in here. Yeah.
Is it in here?
It's just not shown on this page. So we could get you the full list or something like that. It's in there.
Because we're showing what 20 something. I'm not counting, but there's 65.
Yeah.
Really, 80 probably in total, right?
Oh. Okay.
There is some.
Okay, so 70. Yeah.
All right.
So diversifying returns are higher. Potentially, trades are higher. Active management to manage those risks and evaluate more times harder local currencies and issues. And any other questions on the asset class before we start looking at allocations?
Jeff, Darren, any
questions? So how long typically the money's locked in for? Like, is there flexibility of you know, getting out of it.
There is very liquid funds, daily liquidity, or maybe monthly, but the ones that I've worked with are daily.
So most bonds would be available for trading any market.
Yeah.
On market business day.
Yeah, that's part of the good news in the chart of the showing the growth to $3 trillion is that it's become a more liquid marketplace, that there's more institutional investment in there, so you can buy and sell much easier.
Okay. Shall we switch gears to mass allocation?
So,
members, you want to move on to the allocation issue? Or?
You can always ask.
Yeah, let's get to it.
Okay.
It's been on the table for 3 months.
Okay. All right. So this item is 7B3. It's a discussion and action item, and staff's recommendation will be to approve alternative asset mix B. There you go. To authorize Veris to conduct a manager search for the emerging debt allocation contingent on the approval of mix B. And then update Stansara's investment policy statement to reflect the revised asset allocation. And Chris, if you want to just kick the ball and get us going,
sure.
And start talking.
So again, I've seen this a couple times now. I think the first time we saw it, there were only two mixes, A and B, if I'm not mistaken. One that had emerging market debt, one which didn't. Oh, I can use my laser here, so I got that in here, right? That's the difference essentially between A and B. Board members had some comments saying that perhaps we want to consider or at least look at some allocations that don't have private markets, that don't have emerging market debt. So Veris went back and helped us put together these mixes, C, D, and E, and we can talk about those. In your packets, I can flip back a little bit here on the screen as well, but you'll find this page, which is 15, and the next page, 16, fairly useful because what we found, Rick and I in our review, is that C, D, and E simply don't come out to be as optimal in our opinion. That is the reason for a recommendation. That said, if there's philosophical reason to not be in certain asset classes, by all means, that's what they're there for. So I flipped to page 16 here. And again, you can see mixes A and B were presented on May 22nd, and we've got some other tools. Let me point to a couple of key numbers that we look at. One is obviously this top line, which is the forecast 10-year return. 6.6 and 6.5 are shown at A and B here. We generally go down when you exclude private market and emerging market debt, although D is still quite high at 6.5. What we give up for that is this next low volatility. B actually has the lowest standard deviation. It's expected to be the less, at least, volatile portfolio here, whereas some of these other ones increase. Mix D substantially so. Okay. The Sharpe ratio we find very useful, the unit of excess return per risk taken. It kind of maxes out here with mixes A and B. Again, it kind of leads us to prefer mixes A and B. We've got some other scenario analysis below. It's quite thorough. And these are five options that we are all optimal in their own respect, kind of depending on what you want to include. So B, again, includes allocations to private equity here, private credit here, and EM debt. A, the only difference there really is we don't do the emerging market debt and those funds get allocated elsewhere. And then C, D, and E have much more in the public markets, in particular D has a lot in the U.S. The request of board to look at this. No emerging market debt and no private equity, no private credit. So these are very traditional portfolios. Any comments, Ed, with it?
No, I think you nailed it. I think we were just trying to incorporate questions from the initial meeting about mixes A and B and saying what if this or what if that, and I think that was the intent of C, D, and E, so that's why we should. The only other points I would make, I guess, then, is the scenario analysis when you get to page 20. So this is another helpful way. So Chris appropriately pointed out the lower volatility, or higher, depending on which mix. This is another way of seeing that, taking these portfolios and running them through past events and seeing how they behave. And so what we like about mix B is that it has the lowest drawdowns through all of the challenging periods. You see them on page 20. On page 21, a similar story, although the 1994 U.S. rate hike, it does not have the lowest return. So that's that top one, and that's a rising rate environment, and the portfolio has more credit and bonds built into it. So that's why it would underperform in that environment. Everything else, though, all the other drawdowns, it's a winner. So we just think that that's really important in terms of the pension plan. Playing defense is really important. When you have the assets preserved during the drawdown, that gives us flexibility to reallocate the portfolio and to take on more growth exposure, more risk exposure, expecting to capture some of the upside, which is really the fundamental tenet of the FFP design, that we wanted to have dry powder. We have a lot of short-term fixed income. We have indexed treasury bonds. We have the risk parity strategies. When the market corrects, we want to be able to buy into that and not have to sell out of it. So.
When you say drawdown, you mean when it loses money, it loses at least?
Correct. Yeah, I don't know where we invented drawdown. A correction.
I like meltdown here.
Yeah, meltdown. Yeah, when it loses money. Yeah. Yeah.
So this is the financial crisis, 2007-2009, one that I'm pretty familiar with here recently, where the other portfolio was expected to fall into 30% of it. So that's 300 basis points, right? 27%. That's the idea. It's been a while since we've had to think about defense, really. It's been a very offensive environment for pricing markets.
Ed, would you say that AltMix A is as close as any of them to what your original recommendation, Barris's recommendation to us, was a year and a half ago or so?
As close to any, yes, I would think so. It does change the mix, though, in terms of the international and domestic equity exposure, which I think has been a topic for us in the past. Mm-hmm.
So that's a good point. So a year and a half ago, you can kind of see that in the long-term targets column. This is something the board's already approved, actually. And so I think that's accurate. AltMix A is quite similar between domestic and international.
Well, what's the sentiment of the board? How do you guys want to proceed?
I think the biggest heartburn in terms of this whole discussion, I think it's confusing the issue between private credit and emerging market debt, is the fact that we introduced emerging market debt into the conversation.
At the same time?
Yeah. Okay. And I would be very comfortable in removing that discussion and taking all the column all mix B out of the equation, because I think it confuses things. And it's a little bit of a defensive position. It's a couple of notches safer, but not in terms of the risk, but not a whole lot. And since there seems to be so much heartburn about it, I think I'd take it off the table.
So that would lean towards AltMix A, essentially, which actually has a slightly higher expected return, 0.6, and some slightly different risk characteristics, but still the same Sharpe ratio. And it would include private markets.
Yeah. If Ed was advising me on the best way to put in a plumbing system, mm-hmm. my guess is he'd be all wet. On the converse is, that's my trade. So we hired him through a long process to advise us on how he thinks we should do a modern portfolio of $2 billion, which is way beyond my school of expertise. And so I'm comfortable with being as close to what his original recommendation was with some of the modern updates. I think in the long run, we're going to look back if we don't go into private equity and see that we've missed a component. It's not going to be a world changer, like what Rick said, with the exception of it's going to be $100 million of our portfolio that could be clicking in at 15 or 20% if we have a good cycle. Whereas if that doesn't happen or we don't go there, we're going to look to the county to start writing another $48 million a year out of their general fund to make up the other 0.25% that we're not getting. And they've had to absorb that fortunately in an upcycle in the last 4 or 5 years and continue to go forward that way. So we really haven't, acclimated to having to live with, but we've already raised the fee on it.
I understand that, Jeff. I just don't, I have a real problem with the blank check, a serious problem with the blank check. And, you know, we talk about private equity as almost as if the industry strikes me as what the most successful ones are the hardest chargers, the smartest. And frankly, their job is to go loot and pillage and burn and get the profits. And I get that, okay? I don't know if I want to take Stan Sarah money and invest in that tactic. And the lack of transparency is mind-boggling in my mind. So I have a real problem with the whole concept.
I think the lack of transparency, too, bothers me. The emerging market debt, I wouldn't put a cent into that. I couldn't, outside of maybe another hedge fund, I don't think we could do a worse investment than that. Especially these kind of countries that are on the list. I mean, if you look at, you know, this sheet here, the American equities, who did so well. It's what I'm familiar with and what I'm comfortable with. I'm not comfortable with this stuff at all. And I just see, you know, this group, Verus, trying to move us out of American equities, you know, from where we are to half what we used to be. And putting it into these obscure, questionable types of investments that are just adding on additional money managers' fees for investments that myself, I wouldn't put any of my money in. But we got enough money managers already without having to go into investments that's going to require more of them. I don't like any of them. I absolutely will not vote Mix B. And I really question, you know, the soundness of this private credit, you know. I like American equities. That's what I'm comfortable with. And that's what's made us money in the past.
Members?
Michael? Well, I don't have a problem with the global equity or the emerging market. You know, I think it's a global economy, and I think we can take advantage of some upside globally. I don't see a problem with it. I think if you hire the right manager who's aware and has a good track record, I don't see an issue with it. But that's just where I'm at.
Rhonda, anything to say?
I have the same opinion, Michael. I think we should step it up and get with the rest of the investment world and look at some of these other areas where we could be making money, and our job here is to make money for our trustees. I don't see a big concern with a small amount of money as we're talking about our percentage of our portfolio in either A or B. I personally prefer B because I think the emerging markets are, especially the hard debt, they're obviously emerging, which means they're growing and producing more income and whatnot. So that's where I stand.
Anyone, Donna, anybody else have any comments?
For me, I'm comfortable with B, but I'm fine with A. I don't have any problem with either one, but I think we have to look towards how the markets have changed, and it's a forward-looking view that we have to take.
And the other thing is, this is long-term. Right. I mean, even though you said it's liquid, and I suppose it's liquid enough that, you know, things. Well, if everything goes to hell, everything goes to hell.
That's true.
Even, you know.
Even.
So, but. One thing that, I was just at Berkeley and went to the class, which I highly recommend. But we have a long time to make sure that we have ability to pay our benefits into the future. So I think we really shouldn't be so myopic and just think, oh gosh, what happens in 3 years? We're talking about 20 years. And if you look at any of those charts, not going to time the market, but if you were in there from the beginning, you're fine.
So I'm looking at the total growth portfolio. You know, our phase one targets were 63% in total, and with both with mixes, mix B is in line with that in the scheme of things, and so A and B are both in line with that. So I'm comfortable with either one. I like their defensive positions. I think U.S. equity at some point will give some. You know, there'll probably be a drawdown at some point in time. So it's okay to play defense. You know, sooner rather than later. So either one. I could live with A if this, you know, if members are not comfortable with emerging market debt, you know, just because we're dealing with these other countries that, you know, maybe not always play by the rules and so forth. So, but, you know, either one doesn't give me any personally any issues.
But did you say, though, that we could say we don't want to invest in Guyana and we don't want to invest in Chile, or that we could be specific or not?
You probably could. You probably don't want to. You probably want to turn that discretion over to the manager who's doing the research much deeper than we are.
But you can say the index that you want to participate in, and that would limit it in some ways. Some indexes can include some countries. On the other hand, emerging markets is a roulette wheel, and to some extent, and where the problems are today is not necessarily where the little ball is going to land tomorrow. And you know,
even major markets, given the
I'm old trade. Enough to remember Brazil.
Yeah.
Yes.
And hyperinflation issue. I mean, it does happen.
So Mike, I hear what you're saying about on the private equity side with some of these outfits. That's going to come down to what managers we pick. Whoever we turn it over to as far as our consultant.
Well, I think I have a way to move this forward. Go ahead.
So that's one issue. It's going to depend on who you pick. So, like recently, if you look at Toys R Us, a lot of money went into that. It had good brand ID, and they let the current leadership run that because they thought they were capable. Obviously, they weren't, and it ran it into the ground. So there wasn't an issue of burning and pillaging, although some outfits do that. Again, it's going to come back to who we pick for who our consultant picks. Jim, to your point, I have some of the same concerns with going into some of these international investments. But I think if you look at the economy as a whole now, if you look at some of the strongest drivers, what we see as strong American companies. So let's pick McDonald's. McDonald's now gets most predominant amount of their income returns are all from overseas. They consider the U.S. market to be already to a mature point. All of their profits now are being, and their targets are all overseas. Boeing is the same in the same place. Caterpillar is obviously tied to the emerging markets. So I think your point, and I agree with you, from a rule of law and regulation standpoint, U.S. Placement is a safe place to be. But I think if you look at the economy as a whole, it's all in emerging. I tend to agree with Trustee Grover that alt mix A. I have some major concerns about and feel the concerns of what the other trustees are saying about emerging market debt. So I feel more comfortable with alt mix A.
Emerging market debt can always be picked up at any time in the future too. If we decide not to include that today and sentiment changes or conditions change, we'll
And I understand putting it in there. It's an alternative to, you know, basically getting your zero returns in our own fixed income. Mm-hmm. So it's an alternative to a fixed income strategy, which is basically zero right now, and it's lap death throes, I think. But, you know, there's a lot of risk there.
You said that well, though, in terms of when we're looking at creating a portfolio and trying to do the best, we got to show you everything we think sure. is worthy of consideration. So, I mean, the risk-return characteristics are up there. You can see why they would show up as being worthy of an allocation. So there, if we're not ready, if it doesn't make sense for this group, that's fine.
Lauren, did you have anything you want to offer?
No, I mean, 3 months ago I was fine with Plan B. I still am. I think we live in a global world and there's impacts everywhere. However, if there's some of us who are more comfortable with Plan A, that's fine. Either one of the two are fine with me.
And any other members have any?
No, should we just make a motion?
Yeah,
on
but I'd like to ask a favor first. I don't want to vote for the private equity thing as it is currently structured, but I don't want to vote against everything. So if someone would make a motion, or if I can make a motion to reverse our position on private equity, I would do so. And if it doesn't pass, it doesn't pass, but it doesn't have to tie us up. I can't make a motion.
As the chair? Well, we do have three alternatives here which do not include private equity, and anyone could make a motion for any of those portfolios, the C, D, and E, that's what they're there for.
Well, I'll do that for you, I guess. Okay. This is a motion to remove private credit?
Yeah, private equity. The other one is will come up second.
Okay, the mix will come up second. Okay.
Can I second the motion? Am I allowed to second the motion?
What is the What is the motion exactly?
To take us out of private credit.
So mix is...
Wait, you said two different things.
I'm sorry, private equity. I apologize.
Is equity what you want?
Yes.
You don't want investing in the equity side of owning companies.
I don't want to invest in private equity where we don't have authority over the investments.
You can just state that by choosing C, D, or E, right?
Yep.
Because none of those have that inclusion.
Out of those, that's the easiest way to do this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if those are going to come up for a vote.
Well, so when we eliminate private equity and emerging market debt, those three portfolios are what's most optimal that's left. So,
okay.
Yeah, I would definitely phrase your desire that way.
I'm totally confused.
Okay, so we have given you three portfolios that don't include emerging market debt or private equity. That's C, D, and E. So I think to get to the heart of what you want, you might want to phrase your proxy motion to be either C, D, or E. That you would be
okay,
willing.
So I would support.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's talk about some of the differences here. D has the highest allocation to U.S. large cap, whereas E is the lowest allocation, it's not more.
So D was in response to a question about why do we have so much in short-term gov credit? Do we need that there? All the other mixes are right around the 20% as a function of the FFP sizing exercise.
Yeah.
So it brings it down to 10, and then it reallocates elsewhere.
You
so
know
then
what?
That gets you to the 30 and 30 on the equity side and total growth portfolio at 71.
Yeah,
so you'll see that mix then on the next page has the highest volatility and greatest drawdown of any of the portfolios, and then you see that as well on pages 20 and 21.
Okay, let me say something right now, is that if the board chooses mix C or E, then we need to also have a discussion about bringing the discount rate down, because that won't get us to our discount rate. D would. That would still get us around a 7.4% expected return when we use our inflation figure, but C and E will not.
Observation as well?
You may.
C, D, and E also takes us out of private credit.
Yes, they do. So
which we have, what, $200 million right now?
$100 million.
Yeah, we would have to let that wind down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we just, and they are winding down now anyway.
Okay. Also, D is kind of a reversal of what we decided, was it a month or two ago, with the 7 years of benefit payments funding? So we're going to go from 20 to only 10% in short-term fixed income. Right on the cusp, perhaps, of what we allocated to fund Well, regardless, they
I don't think that's an issue. I think they want to get a work around that.
Well, it was never seconded.
Okay.
D is a very volatile portfolio. I won't use the word risky. It has a high expected return of 6.5. It does have the highest standard deviation, so it's volatility, how much we expect the portfolio to bounce around. This statistic here, the fifth percentile return over 1 year, think of this as kind of a worst-case scenario, a 1 in 20 chance to get a really bad year. What would you expect this overall portfolio to fall? This one would you expect to fall over 11%, which is 6, compared to some of these other ones at year 9. So public markets are very volatile. I think we don't recognize that because we are familiar with them. We understand what the stocks are, but they really do change values very easily based on sentiment.
Well, there's no motion on the floor.
Is there?
But Jim,
no, he didn't get a second. So motion dies for lack of a second. So is there any other motions?
I'll make a motion to accept Ultramix A.
I'll second it.
Which one is? Let me see where
it takes out the emerging market.
Yeah. Got it. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, please call. Any discussion? Members? Please call the roll.
Michael O'Neill?
No.
Jeff Grover?
Yes.
Mandeep Dillon?
Yes.
Lauren Klein?
Yes.
Darren Garrett?
Yes.
Sam Sharp?
No.
Donna Riley?
Yes.
Jim DeMartini?
Yes.
Mike Lynch?
No. Okay.
Motion passes 6-3.
Okay.
That is for mix A.
Rick, do we need a motion for the other two?
For the second one,
because it says we need a motion for the approval of the
No,
state?
That would include everything. Okay. That was staff's recommendation today.
This
oh,
is the one I had
yes, no, you mean for number three.
Two and three, do we don't have to, because we only talked about the first part.
You're right. No, but I think we're good. I think we all know that we don't need to do those two things, having go off the emerging market yet. So your vote included to update our investment policy as well.
Which we do as a matter of course.
Right, that's just a matter of course. So the next item is 8A. We're getting into the administrative part of the agenda. First item is Information Technology Solution Project Update from Don Lee.
Okay, our project is still going well, but it was a very interesting month for us this time. We accomplished a lot. We did finish the utilization testing for the module that is going to be bringing in the contributions. And now we are continuing to work with the employers to get everything formatted so that we can start receiving test files from them. So that was a big accomplishment. We continue to work on the calculators for everything from buybacks to benefits. But we also were working on the calculators that need to be used for a domestic relations order, which is in a divorce when we need to split the benefit between two people. Historically, Stan Sarah has done it just following the Brown rule and everything where the non-member cannot retire until the member retires, and at that point they become eligible for their percentage of the benefit. There is an option in the 37 Act that allows for what are referred to as split accounts, where if it gets adopted by the Board of Supervisors, we could actually, at the time of divorce, split the money according to the court order and move X number of dollars in contributions and service to the non-member, and the member keeps the rest. There are many, many options in there that would have to be decided of how to do this. So we spent some time doing some research on this, and we found out that there are a lot of systems that do it. But when we were working with Tegrit, we know that in the RFP, they agreed that they are capable of doing it, But because it's not a process we were already doing, it to do it right now, it would cause a several-month delay on our project because we would have to start from square one, do all of our research, come up with all the options, get it to you and then to the Board of Supervisors, and then come up with all of the business rules and have it all programmed. We also still have to have everything programmed the other way because we have probably a couple hundred DROs that are written that way in the hopper of people that may not retire for 20, 30 years from now because they were young when they divorced. So we would have to have it set up for both ways. If we do it now, it would be a little bit cheaper dollar-wise. However, we reviewed our staffing levels and what is the additional work that the project has already put on our staff. We do have staff out with very serious illness, so we're a little short there. And once we sat down and we reviewed everything, Tegret has assured us that once our project is done and it's up and running, that they could go ahead and add this feature to our system later. It will cost a little bit more to do it later. However, it will not delay our project. We had already authorized a four-week hold on our project so that we could review this. Fortunately, it didn't take us that long to get it done. So at this point, it looks like we probably will be able to get everything right back on track. We're going to absorb the couple of weeks that we fell behind. And that's why you'll see this in the risks here, is that we were talking about slowdowns that would happen if we decided to go this way. Ultimately, the decision has been made not to do it right now, but it could be done at some point in the future. And that, even though it will cost a little bit more money that way, another big risk of doing it now is if we stop the project, they were going to take our analysts and put them on another project, and there was no guarantee we were going to get the same analysts back. And they are amazing. They have already put in so much work learning our processes and everything. That was a huge consideration for us as well. So we are moving forward with things the way that we currently do business, and then later on we can consider whether we wanted to add another feature to our business. And so with that, we continue to move on. We have an analyst coming tomorrow to start working on calculators again, so we're just moving right on there, and we're going to move up our testing schedule to try to absorb some of the delay in our testing.
So if we go to a split account in the future, it has to be approved by the Board of Supervisors?
Yes.
Ultimately?
Yes.
Hypothetically, does the non-member get to retire when they want, or do they have to meet minimum age requirements?
There are several options that could be chosen. That's why we would come to the Board of Retirement first and get your opinions. But there are options. If we elected it, the non-member could retire as soon as one of the members reaches, either the member or the non-member. So if the member reaches 50 years of age and the non-member is only 27, the non-member could go ahead and retire. However, their benefit would be greatly reduced because of that young age. On the other hand, if the member is only 27 and the non-member is 50, they can go ahead and retire even though the member continues to work.
So it's literally an independent account for all intents and purposes. But the short
changes the actuarial liability a little bit.
Well, no, because it's all done on an actuarial equivalent basis. The law says you cannot create a system that biased the actuarial cost up or down. So when the actuary does the calculation to split the accounts equitably, they must do it on an actuarially equivalent basis.
Okay.
A shorter answer to your question is essentially the CIRL lets you guys do whatever you want to the non-member account, believe it or not. There is so much which is one of the reasons why it's so desirable, because it would make the administration of DROs so much easier. So I have a feeling what will happen is in a couple years when we're up and running, we probably will bring this issue back to you then. All right.
Any questions, or are you done?
Okay, item 8A, board committee room update. Natalie, do you have anything new to report out?
there's not a whole lot going on with the boardroom, tenant improvement update, the plans are still at business, getting ready to go out to bid, that's kind of been put on hold for review of the plans by the capital projects team, just to make sure the plans are complete. We're gonna get a bid on everything we're gonna need to do that, so hopefully I'll have more of it for you.
We need executive session or public comment?
No, everybody can stay.
All right, the next item is public comment. Why don't we begin with Supervisor Grover?
I have no public comment, thank you.
Member comment?
I don't even have one of those.
Aaron? Rhonda?
I just wanted to reiterate what Michael said. We both went to the Berkeley training, and it was really, really good. And I took copious notes because, you know, a lot of it was all new to me, but really worthwhile, and I understand some things a lot better now, so.
Is that like once a year, Rhonda, do you know, or twice a year?
I think once.
I think just once.
Once a year, but there's
two parts.
There's an advanced next year, which I will go to. I found this very bad, unlike maybe some of Sacker stuff, there's no fluff to this. It from 8 to 5, and they kept us to 5 o'clock on Wednesday when we wanted to get away. But it's very interesting and stimulating. The guy from Washington, Thomas Gilbert, very interesting guy. He's a totally passive guy. He doesn't believe you should pay anything but passive fees to anybody. Everything ought to be passive. That's his philosophy. Very interesting character. Dan had with him. He doesn't believe in fees and doesn't believe in bank war. He doesn't think anything.
I have a copy of the agenda if anybody'd like to see it.
So really, I wish I would have taken this 6 years ago. And I would highly recommend that any new trustee get that message.
That's actually in our.
Is it?
Yeah. And it's recommended for first years.
Yeah, and I don't know that
he was just 5 years late.
Yeah. And I don't know that list was up. Well, I got it 5 years ago. But anyway, I highly recommend it. And it was just, it's still, he took complex things and he broke them down and made them very simple. And I thought I understood him until he started putting the mathematical formulas up on the board. Yeah. And when he started doing alpha and grading it and square this and that, I thought, wait a minute, you just explained it and I understood it. Yeah. Now you're confusing me with all this math, you know. But it's very good.
I agree.
Is that it, Mike?
So Michael used up the balance of your time.
Yeah. Sorry.
Okay. Lauren, do you have a comment?
This is my last meeting with all of you.
Oh, we're sorry.
Dawn is being sworn in as the interim treasurer tax collector on August 1st, and then the formal swearing in will be in January. So it's been fun. It's been real.
Thank you.
It's good to be back, and I'm glad the election's over.
There's always a little tension. Try running as an elected. Let me tell you.
Other than that,
tension there. Yeah, big time.
That's it. Nothing else.
Nothing, but just had a great vacation on the Fiji Islands. So.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
So you can see my tan there.
Donna, do you have a comment?
I am excited to take on a 4-year term starting August 1st and look forward to my continued service on this board.
Any comments from the staff? Okay. Do we have a motion? Oh, I'm sorry.
Just that due to Donna's newly elected position, we will be opening the election for her seat. So that seat, because of the timing and time frame, will probably, we're hoping to be filled by September's meeting, but obviously it will be vacant for August.
Could Laura run for that seat?
I'm retiring.
You'll be perfect.
I have 5 more months.
Maybe sooner. Did you want to take her position?
5 months. Come on.
Okay, we have an executive session item. Can we have a motion to
so move
into executive
second
session? We're in executive session. Is it on? Is the machine on? The retirement board is coming back into session after a closed session. Is there a report on closed session?
Yes. Kelly? I have a readout for item 9A. Motion was made by Trustee O'Neill and seconded by Trustee Dillon to accept staff recommendation to contract with Veris to serve as the non-discretionary consultant for San Sara's private markets program under the terms of Schedule B of our existing agreement executed August 24th, 2015. Authorize staff to execute an amendment to the agreement detailing the scope of services, start date, and terms of payment. A roll call vote was taken. The roll call vote passed 7-2. The two no's were noted as Trustee Lynch and Trustee DeMartini.
Is there, there's no other item to come before the board? Is there a motion to adjourn?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
This meeting is over.
Thank you.